Taking Stock with Vincent Wall.
Brought to you by PwC. We balance business understanding with technology innovation and human insight. PwC.ie.
This is News Talk.
You're welcome to Taking Stock on News Talk. I'm Vincent Wall, and each week we'll be taking a wider view of some of the major shifts in the global economy and those closer to home. You can get in contact with us by emailing takingstock@newstalk.com or on Twitter @takingstocknt. We're joined now by Michael Peel, Financial Times European diplomatic correspondent and author of The Fabulous, The World's New Rulers, Their Myths and the Struggles Against Them. Michael, thank you very much for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Vincent.
It's a wonderful read, Michael, of your first-hand and very insightful accounts of various jurisdictions and regimes around the world, from the Middle East to the Far East, autocrats and demagogues, and how they use stories and myths to leverage power for their own purposes. I suppose the interesting thing for our discussion today is how you applied these experiences you've seen to what's happened in the UK in terms of the whole Brexit process and debate.
Yes, I think you're very right to present it as a kind of a journey there, because that's what the book is. It's in some ways a synthesis of almost a decade of experiences of working and traveling, particularly in the Middle East and Southeast Asia, where I was based for some years. And then in 2017, I came back to Europe, and I'm based in Brussels and cover European foreign affairs mainly, and also a bit of the Brexit debate as well, but also as a British citizen, of course, this is Brexit is a very personal experience as well. And I think one thing that interested me was that the kind of patterns that I saw across cultures and regions, between places which were in many ways very different, and of course one should always acknowledge those differences. And this is not to say that, you know, there's a kind of grand universal political theory of everything, but nonetheless there are certain rhetorical methods of political campaigning which I do think have relevance in Europe, including in the Brexit debate. And for example, President Rodrigo Duterte in the Philippines' rise to power is extremely interesting, because the Philippines has been a democracy since the end of the Marcos dictatorship in the 1980s, and was generally held to have quite strong institutions. But then along comes Duterte, who presents himself as a kind of national savior figure, and his campaign, his main, some would say his only really campaign slogan is about ending the drug scourge of the Philippines, which he presents as a kind of narco state. And by presenting the problem in these vivid, exaggerated terms, he gets people on side to then launch this extremely bloody drugs war in which thousands of people have been killed. And he uses all kinds of offensive rhetoric and says that he wants to feed the bodies of drug dealers to the fish in Manila Bay. And there are two things about that which I think are very interesting and do have some application in the Brexit debate in the UK and how it's developed, despite the evident differences. But the parallels are, for example, in this idea that Duterte created, that here's an existential point. We must end the drug scourge of the Philippines, and this becomes the only thing that matters. And in some ways, Brexit has become a bit like that. It's become this kind of focal point around which all other politics must rearrange itself and indeed be subservient to. And there's also this rhetorical inflation that, you know, you have Boris Johnson talking about how he'd rather be dead in a ditch than fail to deliver Brexit on October the 31st, which, you know, and there's language of, you know, enslavement by the EU. I mean, these are pungent terms and to use, and they add this sense of kind of urgency and fear to the debate, which then stirs similar emotions in voters and whichever side of the debate they're on, and makes the whole thing so much more aggressive. And I would argue that has helped to create divisions in British society that were either less or indeed not there at all before. And just circle back to the book, one thing I do is I go to see the old headmaster of my primary school and other Brexit voters in in Torbay, where I used to live, and talk through with them about Brexit. And they, and we, one of the themes that I try to bring out is the amount of common ground we have, and I think many British people have, about certain things that make life in Britain more civilised, and which, for example, shared public spaces, proper healthcare, employment rights, and so on, and how I believe that these are some of the things that could be threatened by the division and the sheer rupture that is caused by Brexit. In other words, you get a situation where, in the end, the vast majority of people, however they voted in the referendum, may end up feeling unhappy.
And is it your view that, that some politicians, some ideologues, if we may call them that, have deliberately used that, that language of servitude and needing to throw off the yoke of the oppressor in the UK to polarise the debate, and that many, many other politicians, decent people, I suppose, haven't challenged that, that debate by telling the truth and how they really feel themselves?
Yeah, I do feel this quite strongly, that, that this has kind of got out of control. And I think, you know, as somebody who spent time working in countries which are in real crisis, you know, including armed conflict, just to hear that kind of language used in a country like Britain is disturbing, and suggests that the people who are using it really don't have any appreciation of what true turmoil is, and or they do, and they don't care how they sound and how overblown it sounds. And of course, in the British context, there's the very particular kind of offensiveness of using the language of enslavement and liberation in a country which, of course, enslaved many other countries and occupied other countries around the world. And so to portray itself as a victim in this is pretty extraordinary. So and I think that does have a very weird sort of psychological effect. It plays to old sort of British pathologies about the lost past greatness and so forth. And indeed, in the conversation with my former headmaster, who's a nonagenarian veteran merchant navy officer from the Second World War, but he goes back to Napoleon, and he talks about, you know, since the days of Napoleon, Britain has had a certain kind of attitude to Europe and has seen off kind of European plots and so forth. And that's pretty extraordinary for, a figure of, 200 years ago to loom so large in arguments on a decision on whether or not to leave an international organization which Britain joined voluntarily some decades ago.
And what I found fascinating was that in your further conversations with that gentleman, you know, his views were actually much more nuanced when you questioned him on particular issues that he felt strongly about. But there's been a lot of analysis about the type of people who voted each way in the referendum now, 3.5 years ago. But I think it's fascinating the way you bring forward the fact that, you know, this wasn't the Brexit Leave vote wasn't a vote by the disenfranchised, by the rump of people who felt that the 21st century had left them behind from the Rust Belt or whatever. These were largely relatively, on both sides who voted, were largely relatively well-off people, well-read and active voters.
Yeah, and I think that's a hugely important point, that this kind of false narrative has developed about what Brexit is. In other words, it makes it out to be a kind of morally virtuous, almost a revolt of the oppressed. Now, the problems with that narrative are that, not that it's completely untrue, because, you know, there's clear demographic evidence that, you know, the people people who were poorer had fewer educational opportunities did vote more often than not for Brexit. So that is true. But what's also true is that there's a great group of Brexit voters, the majority of Brexit voters, who do not feel financially uncomfortable, who life has treated in some ways pretty well, and that, you know, that's really the kind of the foundation stone of Brexit, and that makes sense, right? Because, you know, Britain is not a poor country overall, so it would be odd if, you know, the 17 million people who voted for Brexit, you know, were all very poor. That just doesn't make sense in terms of the demographics of Britain, or even, you know, were not sort of destitute but had lived in areas where which had suffered from deindustrialization and so forth. And what I want to make very clear is that one of the agonies of this for me, one of the tragedies of this, is that, you know, the kind of thing that Brexit has drawn attention to, i.e. the state of British society, its massive inequalities, huge areas of the country which have become more and more deprived. This is something that should have been dealt with long ago, and that this is a failure of British policy over decades from governments of both parties. And that's something I felt quite strongly for a long time. But I don't think that that translates directly into the Brexit vote, which is a much more complicated thing. But it suited politicians on both the right and the left to portray Brexit as a revolt of the righteous, essentially, against their conditions. And while there is some element of that in some people who voted, that's by no means the only or indeed the main story of Brexit. And that's why I think we need to understand better what it means in order to deal with the consequences.
You say Britain isn't a poor country by any means, and that's obviously, of course, the case. But you also point out that one of the reasons, perhaps, why we have got to where we are and why the debate has become so much more polarised is a failure by British politicians and, I suppose, other leaders in society to fully inform and make British citizens aware of their changed position in the world, both politically, in the post-imperial world, and even the strength of their economy, the confusion between the fifth largest economy in the world and perhaps the riches that might suggest people should be enjoying.
Yes, I think that's right. There is sort of loose language and worse. I mean, I cite a survey from 2014 which found that 57% of those surveyed, of British people surveyed, thought that the British Empire was something to be more proud than ashamed of, and only 19% disagreed with that proposition. Now, that's pretty extraordinary. It depresses me, but it also doesn't surprise me in the sense that I don't remember learning very much at all about the British Empire at school. I mean, I sort of absorbed information about it from home, from reading, from seeing TV programs. But the fact is that it was only really when I travelled in places, that had been occupied in Britain, that it suddenly became more real, and I realised not just the historic crime, which I knew about in the abstract, but also the way that this permeated so much through the life of nations in the present day, which of course is not to say that it's the sole determinant of what happens in countries, and of course it would be arrogant to in some way imply that the people of these countries don't have their own considerable agency. But nonetheless, it reverberates through history in a way that I think many British people don't understand. And that's not really their fault. I mean, it's not really in the sense that our education system isn't set up for an honest accounting of British history.
We're obviously at a critical time in the immediate process, Michael, both in terms of what happens in Brussels and in terms of what subsequently happens in Westminster. But whatever way Brexit now happens, and I assume it does happen in some form, what do you think the debate of the last number of years and the use of stories and language and misinformation on both sides means for Britain's future relationship, one with the EU over time, but also its future trading relationship, its ambitions to have a future trading relationship with all sorts of others, economic parties, if it doesn't actually have a fully accurate view of its position in the world?
Well, I worry about this because, I mean, for example, the British are great masters of euphemism in many ways. And one of those ways is the way that you hear politicians talking about doing deals with India, say, and they talk about the historic links between the countries, which is a pretty extraordinary way when you think about it to refer to the British occupation of India and everything that followed. I do worry that there's a sort of lack of realism of both the impact of Britain's history and its current standing in the world. And of course, the great danger of Brexit, and this is something I try to bring forward in the book, that this is not a sort of polemic on behalf of Remain, but rather a kind of a warning and a fear that the sheer divisiveness, the energy that this has sucked out, the way that, you know, we have presented ourselves as a country to the world, could be very, very destructive. It could play on the insecurities that we already see in Britain and make them still more damaging. And, you know, at worst, this will take a country that is clearly not at ease with itself in many ways and turn it into one that, you know, goes into an even deeper kind of social conflict.
Are you worried as well that certainly from the perspective across the Irish Sea, the battering that Britain's well-revered democratic institutions have taken over the last number of years, both in terms of the spotlight on how they perform and function themselves and the agents who have been using them for their own purposes to some degree, that focus could cause problems for British democracy down the line? But also, if the Brexit promise of sunny uplands of new trading relationships don't turn out to be the case or prove much more protracted than they have been portrayed, that it will stir up further ferment in a post-Brexit society in the UK.
Yes, I do worry about that. And I think that, again, the respect that people had for British institutions, I mean, it always seemed to me in some ways exaggerated, strange, even misplaced, because clearly there are so many aspects of British democratic political life which are just odd, from the House of Lords onwards. Indeed, one of the things I do in the book is I go to see a former Liberal Democrat MP in Torbay, and he talks about exactly this, about how his experience as an MP in and around Westminster and all the kind of finery and the cat doffing flunkies around gave a very strange sense of what kind of place modern Britain was, and what the nature of British democracy was. And in some ways, I think that the Brexit crisis, it could almost have been devised by a political science professor to say to his or her students, look, devise me a crisis that hits the British political system at all of its weakest points. And I think we've seen that, the clumsy use of the referendum, the paralysis in Parliament that's followed, the attacks on judges and all the rest of it. It really has exposed weaknesses which were always there, but now are very much, fully open and laid bare. And I think to address your other point, the emphasis now is understandably on will there be a Brexit deal? Will it fly? But if one is done, then very soon questions will turn to the consequences. And I think the idea that if Brexit is done, suddenly, in some way the boil will be lanced and people will feel more comfortable, that Leave voters will feel much more satisfied, and that Remain voters will in the main just shrug their shoulders and say, well, at least it's over. I think that's probably a myth. And I think that that once it is done, then of course there will be huge debate over many numbers of years, wrangling over the future relationship with the EU27 and so forth, and people will start to say, but I thought this was done, I thought it was going to be simple. That anger will grow. There will also be the anger which over the state of Britain and the decay of services and all the other things that are worrying people, and unless there's serious government action on that will continue to grow as well, and that Brexit will continue to be this great vortex that sucks people's energy, that creates divisions and makes it hard for governments to concentrate on the kind of social rebuilding that many British people agree is needed now.
And given the people at the top on both the right and the left of British politics at the moment, and given that the first-past-the-post voting system doesn't necessarily allow for a middle ground too often, there doesn't look like there's going to be any kind of visionary leadership in place to heal the ruptures in British society over the next number of years.
Well, this is what the opinion polls tell us, isn't it? That we have two parties which are, you know, way down on their historic highs of mass membership, and two leaders who are, you know, not very much liked in general, according to the opinion polls. And so that is worrying. And you know, what hasn't been articulated really is a sort of coherent vision of, you know, how to deal with Brexit and how to deal with the many ills of British society in a way that you know is both sort of holistic and also realistic, and that's a debate that again has been kind of completely obscured and eclipsed by the Brexit process itself and the huge attention and disputes that has generated.
You are European diplomatic correspondent for the Financial Times, Michael. You are based in Brussels. You do point out that the EU has many faults, and that many of its leaders bureaucracy have an arrogance about them and a non-accountability about them. But that, you know, it does bring many benefits. Do you think that whatever the economic relationship between the UK and the rest of the EU, depending on the nature of the deal and a transition process, however that unfolds, has political trust been damaged very significantly between the UK and European leaders?
I think it has, and I'm glad you pointed to those observations in the book, because this is important, that you know, there is a tendency perhaps on some on the Remain side in Britain to see the EU as a kind of panacea. Well, it's not, and it's roiled with many of its own problems, and you know, just as there's a kind of humbug to the idea of, you know, the British values that get trumpeted from London, which are, you know, contradicted by Britain's actions. Often the same goes at a European level. You know, you hear a lot about European values, but of course, you know, there are many European nations with dark histories too, other than Britain. So it's clearly a crucial question of how Britain, Brexit or not, finds its place in the wider European community. And you know, clearly there are people here, you know, people who regret Brexit, many people who regret Brexit, who saw the UK as either an ally or an important sort of counterbalancing force to other powerful countries in the EU. So there's definitely still a willingness to have that relationship. And I think people also, you know, realize that the rhetoric of certain, you know, particularly outspoken politicians does not necessarily represent the views of the whole country. So, you know, I think if there's a deal, and once the dust has settled a little bit, then there may be a chance to rebuild those links in a constructive way. But, you know, at the moment, clearly the past 3 years have you know, have caused a lot of damage in the relationship between Britain and the rest of the EU.
As your nearest neighbours, we have deep skin in the game, Michael, as you know, so let's hope it works out as well as possible. But we'll leave it there. Michael Peel, Financial Times European diplomatic correspondent and author of The Fabulous, The World's New Rulers, Their Myths and the Struggle Against Them. Michael, thanks indeed for joining us.
Thank you.
Taking Stock on News Talk.
Brought to you by PwC. AI is transforming business. Read our 6 AI priorities you can't afford to ignore at pwc.ie.
We're joined now by Jonathan Keane, tech journalist with Fora.ie. Jonathan, you're very welcome and thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
We're here to discuss the whole range of so-called cryptocurrencies, particularly Libra, the new digital currency that Facebook and others want to establish globally as early as next year. And we'll talk about Libra firstly. It was formally announced last June by Facebook and others. What is it in effect?
It's effectively a digital currency that will be helmed by Facebook and a group forming an association called the Libra Association, made up of two dozen members. It's in like a cryptocurrency. You might be familiar with Bitcoin and cryptocurrencies like that have been around for a number of years. This is a little different in that it's called a so-called stable coin. It's kind of pegged to the value of a number of actual currencies, traditional currencies like the US dollar, the pound, the euro and the yen. And this would, in theory, give it a little more stability in its price. It's probably one of the wild swings that you see with Bitcoin over the last 10 years or so. So this was a big play by Facebook to really kind of get into digital payment space by effectively creating their own currency, but with a number of partners. But this has also invited a lot of regulatory scrutiny as well.
But effectively, the plan would be, if it does launch, that it would be a global cloud-based payment system whereby payments would be instantaneous using an app on your phone and very cheap.
Yeah, it's borrowing from a lot of technology around blockchain, which underpins digital currencies like Bitcoin. One of the big things that proponents of blockchain will say is the speed of the transactions much faster than the traditional payment channels that we're used to. A big part of that as well is Facebook getting all of these partners together to create a kind of a global association so that these payments would flow seamlessly from one platform to another. So it's not just a payment within Facebook or within Facebook's apps. So they want to kind of create a massive ecosystem where all these payments within Libra would flow seamlessly.
Now, as you say, 28 original members announced for Libra, including Facebook, based in Geneva. Some of those members, some of the biggest international payments companies already out there, the likes of Visa, MasterCard, PayPal and others. But it's run into a lot of problems since it was formally announced in June. Some of those are pushback from central banks and other regulators who are concerned about what this might mean. And some, I suppose, linked to the fact that Facebook is involved itself.
Yeah, it's raised a lot of eyebrows from regulators, both in the US and Europe in particular, raising a lot of questions about how it's going to work in practice. And obviously, Facebook being involved raised eyebrows as well, because their reputation has taken a real battering in the last few years, particularly around the issues of privacy and anti-competitive practices as well. So I think regulators were wondering, well, we've questioned how you handle data for the last number of years. Why should we trust you with this massive, you know, financial services system that you want to deploy? So it got a lot of pushback from, like I said, central bankers and ministers of finance and people that are just really questioning how Facebook, even though they've brought in all these partners so they wouldn't be the sole operator of the system, but they are the leaders of it. So it raised a lot of questions around how it's going to work and should we really be trusting Facebook to run this safely and securely.
Some very strong pushback as well from finance ministers. The French finance minister, Bruno Le Maire, saying he would make efforts to block Libra operating across the European Union. His German counterpart basically saying that no private entity can claim monetary power which is inherent to the sovereignty of nations. In other words, there's this concern, fear perhaps, that this would give power to private companies, not just the data they have, but to impact the financial services sector, perhaps undermine current strong currencies like the dollar and central bank authority.
That seems to be the concern, the primary concern that a lot of regulators raise as far as what this would mean for the long existing financial system and how it might undermine that. Obviously, we don't know how that would actually work in practice because Libra hasn't launched. But I think a lot of central bankers and finance ministers were concerned for some of the reasons I mentioned earlier, but also the fact that this is such a grand scheme as well. It's not like some of the cryptocurrencies that have existed already, which have a relatively small user base in the grand scheme of things. This is Facebook, this is, at the time, MasterCard and Visa are all involved. So it had this kind of wide reach. I think it was probably quite intimidating in a way, but also because there was all these questions that were still unanswered about how it would actually work. And it would possibly take control away from central banks and departments of finances as far as controlling their own country's finances.
And I suppose also be open, at least potentially, to black market, criminal, money laundering, all sorts of negative uses.
Yeah, but at the same time, that those are concerns that are raised on kind of any kind of financial system that can be abused for money laundering and for, you know, criminal financing or anything like that. But again, those are questions that haven't really been answered yet by Libra as far as in practice how they're going to be addressed.
Now, in the past 2 weeks or so, seven of the original 28 founder members have pulled out, including the big payments companies, the likes of Visa and PayPal and MasterCard. Stripe also out. Booking.com left as early as this Monday. Is that because of the challenges already faced by Libra over the last 4 months?
It would appear so. I think the massive regulatory pushback was probably a lot more than they anticipated. Also, there was many reports over the last few months about how involved these companies actually are. They've certainly expressed an interest and they maybe signed up preliminarily. But maybe when they saw how it was coming together, they were concerned as what kind of shape this is going to take. Obviously, I keep going back to the regulatory pushback. And obviously, these companies, they're in the payment space, so they have a lot to gain from Libra, but they'd also have a lot to lose from it if it didn't work out or if it was...
It could actually become a competitor to them.
Exactly. So as far as what shape the relationship would actually take, that was never known because they've pulled out. But I think because they were the massive companies like Visa and MasterCard, I think them leaving was really battered Libra's credibility in a lot of ways, because they brought in these traditional legacy players into this brand new payment system. It probably looked good on paper, but it's probably going to be a major setback for Libra, but obviously they're powering on with it.
Yeah, and the Libra Association, the 21 remaining members, met for the first time this week in Switzerland. They said they will power ahead. They say there are other members that potentially can join. They say they still have a target launch date of sometime in 2020, but only if they get regulatory approval in the two key markets of the United States and the European Union. That looks highly unlikely, doesn't it, as things stand?
Certainly as it stands, yeah. It's almost impossible to predict exactly how it's going to pan out. Obviously, they're going ahead with it. I think there's going to be a lot more meetings in the next few months to try and placate regulators into believing that this is safe and viable.
A lot of pushback in the United States as well, particularly from the political system and particularly from Democratic senators. Mark Zuckerberg has now been called to testify before the House Finance Committee next week. The chairwoman of that committee, Maxine Waters, has been very strong in her pushing back on Libra. Are we likely to get any further details from Zuckerberg as to what's involved next week?
It was certainly interesting to hear what he has to say. I mean, David Marcus, the guy who heads up Libra, has been really the public face of this since it was launched. This will be kind of one of the first times where Mark Zuckerberg really kind of takes center stage and, I guess, makes the case for Libra. So I think people will be watching that very, very carefully. But obviously, he's going to be under a lot of scrutiny, as Facebook is in general in the US right now, with a lot of kind of pushback on antitrust matters. So I think given the departures of Visa, MasterCard and all the others, he's really going to have to make a strong case for why they've seemingly lost the trust of these major partners, but why they're going to go ahead with these existing partners and why it'll work.
Now, we've been talking about Libra, which, as you say, is a proposed stable digital currency as distinct from an outright cryptocurrency. But the regulators, particularly the Securities and Exchange Commission in the United States, beginning to show their teeth and get more actively involved in regulating the affairs of some of the real cryptocurrency players, particularly those companies that are raising significant amounts of new capital through digital coin issuance.
Yeah, late last week, a company called Telegram, behind the messaging app, they've been planning to launch their own blockchain service called the TON blockchain or TON blockchain. They raised $1.7 billion through that sale issuance back in 2017 or into early 2018, and then went silent. Then it was supposed to launch again. And then now the SEC is basically coming in and saying this doesn't fly, this looks like a security. And it's a similar thing happened with another company called Block One. They launched a blockchain called the EOS blockchain, which raised $4 billion, but they got slapped with a fine of $24 million, which is probably paltry in comparison. But it certainly shows that the SEC is taking a massive interest in how these cryptocurrencies are playing out. And
the principal concern the SEC seems to have through its court filing last Friday is that these companies, through issuing new digital coin capital issuance, they're effectively avoiding having to disclose all sorts of regulatory information that a regular IPO, a regular new share issue would have to do.
Yeah, and that's been a concern about a lot of digital currency projects and cryptocurrency projects over the last few years. I mean, back in 2017, there was a big initial coin offering buzz where many startups were raising millions of dollars on the back of selling these their own digital currencies. So it's been kind of brewing for quite a while, but I think just when the scale of it with Telegram and EOS, it really kind of highlighted how, I guess, the SEC needed to act, that they could, in theory, sell these to really anyone without kind of showing who they are. So there certainly is more regulatory pushback there as well, as far as having to kind of validate your offering rather than just launching it.
And I think under the system, these companies claim that they're only selling their initial new digital coins to very well-heeled investors who should know the risk they're taking. But of course, once those coins are out there in the market, there's nothing to stop them going to the secondary market, and anybody can buy them without potentially knowing the risk.
Yeah, that seemed to be one of the major kind of defenses of the Telegram project, in that it wasn't sold to the public. It was in a private sale, and it was mostly kind of institutional investors and venture capital firms that got involved. So, yeah, in theory, they should know what they're doing. But to your point, once the blockchain fully launches to the public, then it's kind of it's out there for everyone.
Getting back to the Libra project, not all regulators have been absolutely black and white in their opposition to the proposed project. Mark Carney, Governor of the Bank of England, I suppose, has been most nuanced. And he said, you know, that regulators such as the Bank of England should have not necessarily an open door, but an open mind to it. And he as recently as yesterday, said that he could actually see this going ahead, although it would have to be very tightly regulated. And one of the reasons he would like to see something like this perhaps coming in under regulation is to disrupt the traditional banking payment market, which is expensive, can operate very slowly, and controlled by a lot of the big players. Getting into that market, we've seen a lot of new players, not in the cryptocurrency area, but in the electronic payments digital market, coming into Ireland as well.
Yeah, there's been a number of big players that have been active here for a while, like Revolution N26, kind of offering these kind of so-called neobanks, these alternative banking apps and services. It's fintech, broadly speaking, is extremely hot area. In just look where all the venture capital money is flowing. So there are a lot of services that are launching around Europe, in particular in the UK, and they're kind of coming more into Ireland as well. Even just recently, there was a company from the Netherlands called Bunk, which is kind of a similar service to Revolut N26, and they came in. So there's a huge market there for the taking. But it's also a very competitive market, in the sense that they've got to take on these, you know, massive incumbent banks that have been, you know, in stalwarts for so long.
And by and large, the likes of N26 and Revolut already here, my own daughters are very avid users of them. Bunk coming in, perhaps the British banks, Monzo, Starling as well. Are they really targeted principally at younger people, perhaps making overseas foreign exchange transactions? Can they really get in and disrupt more traditional and, I suppose, more complex banking markets such as lending, mortgage lending, that kind of thing?
I think lending is probably something that a lot of those companies will look at down the road, though it's extremely risky business to get into. But it seemed like a logical step to kind of follow once they've done foreign exchange and they've done mobile payments. They've made all of that very easy, maybe streamlined it nicely, so and it's very easy and comfortable to use. The next logical step would be to kind of get into lending. But as far as the shape that might take and the risks involved, I'm not sure what company's going to get it right first and or who's going to, you know, suffer for it.
And I suppose for all their easily used cards and very user-friendly apps, they still only have, what, maybe 1%, 2% of the consumer market here, although more of them are coming in. Those that might actually succeed, I suppose, are open to acquisition by the conventional banks.
It's even funny you bring that up. There was reports this week that RBS was once interested in acquiring Monzo in the UK. So they're certainly caught the eye of the incumbent banks. Again, while these companies like Revolut and Monzo, et cetera, all seem quite big, and they are big, but as you mentioned, it's still only a sliver of the financial services market, generally speaking. So we could see consolidation in the market down the line, but I mean, as it stands, it's quite a vibrant and competitive space.
Okay, we'll leave it there. Very interesting to see how those disruptive digital banks will take on the big players both here and abroad, and really interesting to see where Libra goes and how soon, if ever, it does launch. We look forward to hearing Mark Zuckerberg next week. Jonathan Keane, tech journalist with Fora.ie. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Taking Stock on News Talk.
Brought to you by PwC. AI is transforming business. Read our 6 AI priorities you can't afford to ignore at pwc.ie.
We're joined now by Catherine Ellen Foley, health and science reporter with Quartz Online. Catherine, you're very welcome and thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Now, we're here to discuss today the growing area of direct-to-consumer testing. Huge advancements, of course, in the whole human genome project over the last 20 years, DNA sequencing. And we're all aware, I suppose, of people who have used genetic testing to review their ancestry and how far back their ancestors go and what qualities they had. But an increasing number of people using direct genetic testing to get a read on their health, and that's causing all sorts of issues.
Well, I think the biggest problem with it is that people are taking these direct-to-consumer genetic tests as more definitive views of their health. And unfortunately, the things that are available directly to consumers or are really consumer products, even if they go through a physician, those aren't necessarily medical-grade companies, something that your personal physician would order for you. And there's a lot of uncertainty in there as well. 23andMe, which is the only direct-to-consumer testing company in the U.S. that is truly direct-to-consumer, you know, although they look at different places on the genome with different known mutations that may put you at higher risk for one condition or another, you know, they may be looking with the at three places on the gene, but genes are thousands of what we call base pairs long. So if three of them are okay, that's not exactly that means that you have three base pairs that don't put you at a higher risk for developing something like cancer. That doesn't mean that there are other problems, that there could be other problems on your gene that you don't know about. So it's important not to take, not to assume that because, you know, nothing turns up on one of these direct to consumer genetic tests, that means you're in the clear. Conversely, we know that in addition to genetics, your environment plays a huge role in your health. So, you know, churning up that you might be at a higher risk for developing something like Alzheimer's later in life, it's not necessarily a guarantee that you're going to develop the disease.
And 23andMe, the one that you cite there as being the only real direct-to-consumer genetic testing company in the United States, it already had its license to do so suspended by the Food and Drugs Administration.
That's right. What was happening is the FDA wanted to make sure that 23andMe was providing accurate reads of people's of people's genomes in the specific places that they were looking. So 23andMe had been advertising that they could assess health risks for, I think, 10 or 11 different conditions prior to the FDA's cease and desist notification. They have 23andMe has received authorization from FDA once more to go ahead advertising and marketing these direct-to-consumer genetic tests, but it was only after they proved that their tests were accurate and that they were low risk to consumers, meaning the risk being what we sort of discussed before, which is that you either have a false positive or a false negative. And 23andMe does do a very good job advertising that their results are not to be taken as strict medical advice. You need to get them confirmed by a healthcare provider or talk to a healthcare provider before you go take action on them.
Now, this is a growing business, obviously. Millions of people have already sought these kits from companies. Estimated it could be a $2.5 billion industry within a number of years. Even with medical supervision through the agency of a physician, a doctor, Catherine, there are problems because basically the technology to sequence the DNA is outpacing the ability to interpret what those genetic results mean.
Yeah, that's a really good point. I think if you, and it's very different when a consumer takes one of these tests versus, you know, if you're a person who has maybe like a rare undiagnosed condition and you're going to a genetic counselor to try to figure out what's wrong. But broadly with consumers, the main or consumer genetic tests, the main issue is that we may know what a handful of mutations may indicate in the future, but we don't, you're absolutely right. We don't have good data on what we call, likely pathogenic mutations or mutations of unknown significance. So it may turn out that you have mutations in a way that just haven't been studied before. And, you know, even if you are able to identify these mutations with a consumer genetic test, it's not really clear what that mutation means.
Apart from the stress that this may engender in people, the law, wherever there are ambiguities, grey areas, the law will move in, lawyers will move in. And apart from the interpretation of the genetic information, how accurate that might be and who is liable for that interpretation, there's the whole question of a subsequent interpretation in time, better information about a genetic test and how the patient or the consumer is subsequently informed of that new information.
Yeah, that's a great point as well. I believe with 23andMe and now with Ancestry Health, which is a little bit different, but still offering health risk reads from your genome, although that process does require the customer to go through a physician. But with both of those, customers are able to purchase a subscription for a set amount of time. And in theory, owning that prescription means that as updates are available, consumers are able to go get better reads on their genetic information that has already been sequenced. I also know, though, that with other testing companies, it's a one-time read, and then you do with that information what you will. But you're right, it could be updated over time, and there's no good way to, with some services, there's no good way to update users on any new information that testing companies may have uncovered since the customer took the original test.
Some lawyers also suggesting that there isn't a responsibility just to inform the customer or client himself or herself who took the test, but perhaps also extended family members as well.
So that's a really tricky area. And that was actually something I spoke with some of the folks over at Ancestry who've launched Ancestry Health recently. Because as you may know, Ancestry DNA is the single biggest direct-to-consumer genetic test in the world. And for a long time, they really focused on helping users draw family trees and put together a picture or an estimated picture of where their ancestors may have been from. That company recently launched Ancestry Health, and one of my big questions was, well, would you want to, would it be ethical to let extended family members know of a family history or mutation that shows up in a relative that's matched through Ancestry? And at the moment, that's not something that companies are doing. That is health information that is considered private. Ancestry Health does allow you to build a family tree with your family history, which is very similar to what you might give at a doctor's office when you go in and they ask, you know, is there heart disease in your family? Is there cancer in your family? But as of now, those are private. Will there be a day where, a testing company prompts you to take a certain test based on what they know about your relatives and their health risks? Maybe, but that seems like a very difficult legal and ethical gray area, if you ask me.
A real stretch on the whole controversy, I suppose, about how data such as genetic testing is used generally. We've seen cases where extended family data can be used to solve cold murder cases, as in the United States, the Golden State murders.
That's right. That's right. So I believe with that case, they were able to identify a third cousin who had uploaded their genetic information on one of these free databases. And that also is an interesting aspect of direct-to-consumer genetic tests and whether or not you want your information to be public and searchable in a legal sense. I've spoken with some legal experts who've wondered if they're could be if it would be more ethical to have just like a universal genetic database where everybody is searchable. So there's not, an advantage of looking for people who may be related to people who have taken direct to consumer genetic tests. And, you know, it sounds like it could be a good idea for law enforcement, but I also think it operates under the assumption that, privacy will exist in the future the way it exists today. Once that information gets out there, there's no real taking it back. So I personally am very cautious I wouldn't want my information out there, even if it could possibly be used to solve cases. I just, once it's out there, it's really out there.
With the technology changing so rapidly, with the huge appetite that we can see, even for people to get information about their health online, with the huge appetite for more information about people's own personal health, and I suppose with the nuanced interpretations that are still out there as to what the genetic information is saying or how accurate it is, the whole question of legal liability for the information, the accuracy of the information in time, is a big issue. And interestingly, the South Carolina Supreme Court only last year it stated that a testing lab, such as a genetic testing lab, does qualify as a healthcare provider and could be held liable under medical malpractice laws.
Yeah, that's a really interesting point. So I think the good news is that with direct-to-consumer genetic tests, there is a safety net. Most of them will require you to go through a second healthcare provider and get a similar genetic test done, but at a medical-grade facility to verify your results before you go ahead and make a medical decision based on what you've seen. The other good news with direct-to-consumer genetic tests is at the moment, those tests are not legally allowed to definitively diagnose any kind of condition. So there are certain diseases, for example, where a single mutation, it means that you will go on to develop a condition. Huntington's is an example of one such condition. And a direct-to-consumer genetic test would never be able to tell you if you are going to develop that, if you're going to develop Huntington's, because that would be a definitive answer. So the only thing that they're able to tell you is if you're at a heightened risk for developing a certain condition or not. And in that case, there's still a little bit of wiggle room. They could be wrong. They don't know your environmental or lifestyle factors that may play a role in your risk of developing that condition. The advantage here is that it empowers you to talk to your healthcare provider. You could say, hey, I think I may be at risk for developing something like Alzheimer's disease. Are there any lifestyle modifications that you would recommend I do, knowing that I have one copy of this gene that puts me at higher risk? So yes, they can inform users about their health to a certain extent, but there's still this safety net of knowing that it's not certain one way or another, and users still have to go to a healthcare provider to talk through to verify that information and to talk through what it means in terms of actionable items they can do for their health.
I did some very basic research on the situation here in the European Union, Catherine, before I came on to talk to you, and it seems to be very varied here, very patchy, a no standard situation. The German government seems effectively to ban direct consumer genetic testing for health reasons fully. Other jurisdictions, depending on an EU directive that effectively just manages the clinical accuracy of the tests themselves. What's the situation in the United States? Is it state by state? Is there a growing demand for much greater standardization and clarity at a federal level for law to govern this growing area?
Well, at a federal level, there are laws that state that you need to have authorization from the U.S. Food and Drug Administration before you can say or advertise that your product can inform you about your health in any way. There aren't really laws for other traits that you might see genetic testing for. So there are a bunch of companies that we've seen pop up that have certainly more dubious science behind them. So traits like, you know, do you have genes that could make you a super athlete, or do you have genes that could make you prefer a certain type of wine? And also, can we sell you some wine at the same time? So those tests are not regulated by the U.S. Food and Drug Administration. They're certainly a lot lower stakes. It doesn't really matter if you get a test result that says that you should like white wine and you actually prefer red. That doesn't matter a ton. But it certainly means that there are some more dubious products out there that the U.S. Food and Drug Administration doesn't have jurisdiction over.
It's a fascinating topic, and thanks indeed for sharing your expertise about it with us, Catherine. That's Catherine Ellen Foley, health and science reporter with Quartz Online. Catherine, thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, that's it for this episode of Taking Stock. You'll find us as a weekly podcast from Friday mornings on the new Go Loud app, available to download now in the App Store or on Spotify and the Apple Podcast Player. So just search for Taking Stock and you can find us there. So from Taking Stock with me, Vincent Wall, take it easy.
Taking Stock on News Talk.
Brought to you by PwC. AI is transforming business. Read our 6 AI priorities you can't afford to ignore at pwc.ie.